The following presentation was recorded in 1998 at the Faith Builders Workshops on Child Development. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Have your hand out. We'll go ahead and get started while the rest finish. And I want to just say that I'm glad to be here this week. It's exciting to me to be able to share with all of you about children, and especially just to think about teaching. And that's really the focus of the week, is what it means to be a teacher, especially in relation to children and how they grow and develop. I'd like to begin with just some quotes here to get us thinking about children. Rick handed his dad his report card while his father stood silent, still in a state of shock. Rick asked, "Dad, do you think these grades are the result of heredity or environment?" Child development, we talk about a lot of different factors that influence a child's life. And obviously this little guy had overheard a few things about that. On a more serious note, North American parents lead the world in buying books on child care, yet many parents feel helpless and wonder what or who is responsible for their child's behavior. Drescher goes on to say, "But nothing is more rewarding than watching a child move into maturity and independence. We will never have a greater opportunity than helping children become persons who accept responsibility and right living." What is your view of children? When you see a small child, how do you feel? What do you think when you see the small child? You know, a number of years ago, people talked about protecting children in a society, and so when a child was found lost or alone, the community, the culture would rally around them. Now, that's still true among many, many people and in many communities. However, we know from the stories, from the news that we read, that it's certainly not the case like it was at one time. Something has happened to our view of children. And I think it's easier for us to be affected by that or influenced by that than we sometimes think. Charlotte Mason said that children are born persons. They're born persons. Think about that. I want us to think about how we see children, and how that influences then the way we relate and teach. So children are born persons. Here's another longer quote. "Take a small child on your knee. Respect him. Do not see him as something to prune, form, or mold. This is an individual who thinks, acts, feels. He is a separate human being whose strength lies in who he is, not in who he will become." Think about that. It's a powerful statement in relation to how you teach. Let me read that sentence again. "He is a separate human being whose strength lies not in who he is, lies in who he is, not in who he will become. If his choices made now and in the future are to be good ones, this person must understand reality and see the framework of truth. In the shorthand of language, we call this knowing. The child is a person who needs to grow in knowledge." And in Proverbs, we read, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." We also read it's the beginning of wisdom, but it is the beginning of knowledge. "In Christ Jesus are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge." So to bring a child to true knowing is to bring him to Jesus Christ. Well, I have an article here, and again, I want us to do some reflecting, and here we have in this article from a 1986 edition of Reader's Digest entitled, "In Praise of Teachers." And this man is not a Christian man. This article reflects some humanistic thinking about self-improvement and some of these things, but I want you to look through that and beyond it and hear what he says about teachers and the impact and influence a teacher has. I find myself lamenting that the more I write, the less time I have for my students. Though I am in my 21st year as a professor, I wonder, have I stopped thinking of myself as a teacher? This crisis of faith has me remembering, in turn, my teachers, hoping that 2 decades after I was last officially a student, I can learn from them once again. It is not the actual teaching of a subject I recall, but surprisingly, one thing, a moment, some words hurled forth, a single seminal idea. I forget the name of my first grade teacher in Grayville, Illinois. I must have begun to learn from her to read and write, to add and subtract, starting a lifetime of joy in language and misery in numbers. That's not my primary memory, though. She teaches me left from right. I am left-handed. Many first-grade teachers, she whispers into my 6-year-old ear, force left-handed children to become right-handed so they can be like everybody else. She isn't going to do that to me. This teacher will always live in my memory for that one remarkable gesture. In 1948, we moved to a small island east of Miami, which festoons upward in stucco and rococo glory out of a stretch of seashore and sand. It's called Miami Beach. There, Mrs. Rosen awaits me, raven-haired and beautiful, reminiscent somehow of Esther in the Bible. Her husband shows up one day, and she tells us he is going to teach us to draw a star. It has never occurred to me she has a husband. I imagine her waiting for me to grow up to have her for my own. And why should he teach us to draw a star? Everybody knows how to draw stars. Is that how we'll decide who gets her, who can draw the best star? But Mrs. Rosen's husband doesn't teach us to draw just any star. He teaches us to draw a 4-pointed, 3-dimensional star that appears to rise out of a flat piece of paper. This is something called an optical illusion. Magic. Into Mrs. Rosen's class one day slouches a lanky lady with ray gun eyes and skin like polished glass. Miss Barnett is director of the marching unit, a group of 20 boys in white ducks and white shirts who do close order drill for fancy school occasions. Miss Barnett also heads the safety patrol, made up of select students who wear the most extraordinary white bandoliers across their chests, and are charged with managing the safe conduct of children from one side of the busy street in front of the school to the other. To a boy's mind, these are the 2 most prestigious enterprises in Biscayne Elementary School. Mrs. Rosen announces that Miss Barnett is about to do something she has never done before, choose a 4th grader for the marching unit, an organization heretofore made up of solely 5th and 6th graders. Big kids. Unbelievable. More unbelievable is that while I'm glancing around enviously at the likely candidates, she picks me. In the 5th and 6th grades, I am a patrol boy and the leader of the marching unit. Miss Barnett repeatedly preaches with religious fervor an idea I still embrace obsessively. If you're going to do something, do it as well as you can and with all your heart. And if you're going to lead, stand forward, be proud. My own variation on her preachment is that you can't ever fully succeed unless you're willing to risk catastrophic failure. In the 6th grade, Mrs. Ruth Waller, auburn-haired and freckled, so tough and so fair, makes me feel for the first time that I not only can be a member of the marching units and safety patrols of the world, but also a good student. She and Miss Barnett are wise, stern, loving. And I am loath now, a middle-aged man, to think what I might be if fate had not conspired to place them in my life so they could see in me what I did not. At Miami Beach High School, my English teachers torment me to read, to consume vocabulary, and to write constantly. Pat Samuelson, 10th grade, handsome guy, has one of the top 10 pompadours of the history of hair. Big Afro time. I deeply covet most of the girls who deeply covet him. He makes us write a short story. To my astonishment, because I still can't imagine I really, seriously, no kidding around, have any particular worth whatsoever, he tells the class that he's giving me the first A+ he's ever given, and he asks me if I'd read my story aloud. I'm terrified. Part of my terror is simple stage fright. Part, fear of having my secret self publicly judged. But Mr. Samuelson beckons me forward, and his entire demeanor says, "Don't be afraid of anything." So I take my story from him, and in the space of 20 minutes of glory and befuddlement, write a sentence across my life. Mark Medoff, you are hereby condemned for the rest of your days to expose your secret self publicly. In the first semester of my freshman year at the University of Miami, there is Dr. Robert Hively, who has given up a prospering career in optometry to teach literature. He conveys no regrets that he's making a third of the money he made before. He seems utterly delighted to be in a classroom with us, charged with salvaging and enhancing another kind of vision. He has let his curly hair grow somewhat eccentrically for 1958, and he drives a small sports car I crave, which, given his size, he appears to wear around his waist. He teaches me to think beyond generalities. This is not easy, especially when, at 18, I am armed with too little knowledge and intellectual dexterity to give specifics. But it is with Dr. Hively that I see for the first time how thoughtlessly one can label someone or something unfairly, incompletely, and disastrously. Dr. Helen Garlinghouse King looks and sounds as if she came to us directly from her specialty, the Victorian era. In the second semester of my freshman year, this seemingly remote and formal scholar with the bun and the ankle-length rayon dresses is my advanced composition teacher. She's a stickler for grammar. She considers my use of the dash, which I hold to be creative, to be absolutely barbaric. I ambush her boldly after class one day and ask if I can write a short story for next week instead of the assigned paper. Her eyes bore into me. Reading what inside, I can't imagine. "I don't know if you can," she says. "But you may try." And she smiles at me. At 1 o'clock in the morning, the day after I turn in my story, I am awakened by the telephone. I wonder instinctively who has died. Instead of death, there is at the other end of the line the sepulchral voice of Dr. King bearing life. "There's nothing more I can teach you about writing. I'm passing you on." Extraordinary to be passed on to William Fred Shaw, teacher of a legendary course in creative writing. For 3.5 years of college and for years of frustrating young adulthood beyond, Fred Shaw taunts me, cajoles, devastates, and encourages me, and he teaches me most of what little I know about writing, the chief things being there are only two ways to learn to write: read, write. And if you don't have to write, by all means, go into other work. The frustration and rejection are not worth enduring unless one is unequivocally committed. This slightly stooped man with ferret eyes and a laugh like volleying bazookas seems able to make each student feel he's Fred Shaw's only student, and that Fred Shaw has little more to do in life than foster that individual's growth. He is still, aside from my parents, the single strongest influence in my life. As a young man, Fred Shaw taught at a cow college called New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. When I'm ready to leave Stanford University Graduate School in 1966, Fred arranges for me to follow in his footsteps. At Las Cruces, I am an instructor of English. I write prose and announce that I'll publish a novel soon. I convince several people of this, though deep in me, where truth resides, I think I'm writing one of the worst novels since the advent of the alphabet. I am also confused on another front. I don't see how, just because I finished graduate school, I'm suddenly supposed to be grown up. I'm a kid, unformed and uninformed, the antithesis in my mind of what I have been hired to be, a teacher. What do I know to teach? There are teachers at New Mexico State University who teach me. In my first semester, I become friendly with a professor of English named John Hadsel, who is deeply involved in something called the Las Cruces Community Theater. One day he says to me, "Why don't you write a play and we'll put it on?" I do. And that first play, then a one act, opens 8 years later in New York, this time as a three act play. The teaching gift John gives me is as great as the putting on of my first play. A teacher has to be totally unafraid of what he might find out as he teaches and what he thinks he already fully comprehends. Arlene Belkin and Tom Erhard, colleagues now in the university's theater arts department, are role models of 20 years standing. Through all the semesters I watch Tom teach, I never see any lessening in him of love of what he's teaching or the love of classroom exchange. The teaching of the students and the students' continual teaching of the teacher, his commitment is a way of living a life. Arlene Belkin, a kitty cat disguised as a panther, takes me back to Miss Barnett and Miss Waller. It is she who admonishes me constantly to push myself, to go boldly, even recklessly, wherever I dare. That complacency makes for atrophy, and atrophy precedes death. In 1972, I returned to Miami Beach High School to speak to the drama class. Afterward, I asked the drama teacher if there are any of my English teachers still there. Irene Roberts, he tells me, is in class just down the hall. I was no one special in Miss Roberts' class, just another jock who did okay work. I don't recall any one special bit of wisdom she passed on, yet I cannot forget her respect for language, for ideas, and for her students. I realize now, many years later, that she is the quintessential selfless teacher. I'd like to say something to her, I say, but I don't want to pull her from a class. Nonsense, he says. She'll be delighted to see me. The drama teacher brings Miss Roberts into the hallway where she stands. Where stands this 32-year-old man she last saw at 18? "I'm Mark Medoff," I tell her. "You were my 12th grade English teacher in 1958, 18 years earlier. She cocks her head at me, as if this angle might conjure me in her memory. And then, though armed with a message I want to deliver in some perfect torrent of words, I can't think up anything more memorable than this. "I want you to know," I say, "you were important to me." And there in the hallway, this slight and lovely woman, now nearing retirement age, this teacher who doesn't remember me, begins to weep, and she encircles me in her arms. Remembering this moment, I begin to sense that everything I will ever know, everything I will ever pass on to my students, to my children, is an inseparable part of an ongoing legacy of our shared wonder and eternal hope that we can, must, make ourselves better. Irene Roberts holds me briefly in her arms and through her tears whispers against my cheek, "Thank you." And then, with the briefest of looks into my forgotten face, she disappears back into her classroom, returns to what she has done thousands of days through all the years of my absence. On reflection, maybe those were, after all, just the right words to say to Irene Roberts. Maybe they are the very words I would like to speak to all those teachers I carry through my life as part of me, the very words I would like spoken to me one day by some returning student. "I want you to know you were important to me." I was talking to my wife on the phone about noon, and one of my boys had answered the other phone almost simultaneously, and I didn't realize he was still on 5 minutes later into the conversation. And I was telling Marie what I wanted to do after I left here this afternoon, and I'm going to be very busy this week, so I'm trying to carve out minutes here and there for my family. And so I said, "Well, I think I'll come home and I'll go on a bike ride with the boys." And he was still listening, and he says, let me see if I remember the quote now exactly. He says, "Yeah, good one, Dad." Okay. Here, a month or so ago, my wife was putting the boys to bed, which I normally do, but she was doing it that night, and she saw the five-year-old laying there smiling at nothing particular, and she said, "So what are you smiling about?" "Oh, because Dad played ball with us today." Okay, now, I don't do that often enough, but I happened to do it that day. And my point is the same one that's in the story. It's the little things, the little moments in time that make the deepest impression on children. And what is another day to us can be a moment that is never forgotten for a child. A friend of mine always says that one of his greatest fears is, he's been teaching for years, and he said one of his greatest fears is that in one day he could destroy what took months, maybe years, to develop by a simple, careless comment. So obviously my point here, as we think about being teachers, we think about relating to children, is that we consider carefully what our attitude is about children. I was the oldest of nine. We had a big family. I was 18 or 19. I just turned 19 when my youngest brother was born. And so I don't know him very well at all, especially now that he's 14 and I'm 400 miles away. So he is growing up and experiencing life largely without me. It feels kind of strange. He's still my brother. Well, for me, in my particular set of experiences growing up, children were sometimes in the way. If you understand, I didn't always appreciate my siblings. But all of us bring something to that whole perspective of children. And we want to talk more about that. Are there extra schedules for the week? Do we have plenty? Does anyone need a schedule yet? A few of you need them. Okay. I'm sorry, not the full week. I'm the overview for this class. How about those? Do people still need that? Are you needing that? You have that. Are there extras? I want to just go over this briefly. Today we want to establish a biblical framework for understanding children and child development. And we're certainly not going to be comprehensive, but we do want to think about some core issues understanding children. And then Tuesday, we want to look at people and some basic terms in child development. One of my goals this week is that when you leave here, you can think not only begin to think Christianly. I find my thinking is continually developing and subtle shifts, sometimes some fairly major shifts in my thinking in relation to children. But begin to help you think Christianly about children, and also to help you understand and just familiarize you with basic terminology as you might read in an article in, let's say, Reader's Digest, Newsweek, or some other teacher in the larger teaching vocation would begin to talk to you about child development terms. You could be at least basically familiar with the terminology. So those are two things I'd like to accomplish this week. We also want to talk about what's being said and thought in the larger, society about children. Wednesday, look at developmental stages. Look at the cognitive development, language development, physical, emotional, social development, spiritual development, and character development. These overlap somewhat. Thursday, look at learning theory, how children learn, and talk about learning disabilities, gifted children, brain theory, learning styles, higher thinking or higher level thinking. Talk a little bit about using literature to learn. And then Friday, just to pull the loose ends together and think about blessing the children you teach, looking at classroom discipline. And then, as we started out here this afternoon, take another look at you, who you are, knowing yourself and knowing Jesus Christ. Some of these days, we may not cover everything. If we don't finish, we'll start the next day where we left off. And the way this is structured, we'll probably be able to cover everything, at least in brief. I'd like to have I've chosen a song I'd like to sing this week. If you'll take your hymnals, let's take a moment to sing that. Number 467. 467. Let me just again state more clearly what I'd like to have us accomplish this week as we look at child development. To develop a greater appreciation and understanding of the physical, social, emotional, intellectual, moral development of children up through adolescence. And it's a big subject, and like Milo said here at the beginning, this is an abbreviated form of a class. So this will not be in great detail, but we'll try to at least hit the high points. Item B, to discover God's purpose and design concerning child development. This last weekend we had a colloquy, and the subject had to do with a philosophy of teaching. And then we made some applications to teaching in the home, in the school, in those different places. And one of the things that was mentioned in one of the talks was the Bible says very little about how children grow. And we have volumes and books upon books written about teaching children and how children develop and how they grow and what all they need. But the Bible doesn't say a lot about this. And so one thing that we need to understand as we come to child development is it's largely developed on our observations and experience. We look at children, we say, well, this seems to be true of children at this age. Most children seem to have this characteristic. Within this characteristic, there seems to be these differences. And so, like many other things we do, we try to categorize and group and label and all these things. So child development is really a collection of observations and experiences. And what we want to do is look at it in light of what Scripture says. But we need to recognize as well that a lot of this is observed and studied. Item C, to examine creative and practical teaching techniques to be used with children. We want to work hard this week at keeping this close to the classroom and family, but especially the classroom. Item D, to help equip for the task of serving and kingdom building. And that really is the focus of what we want to do here this week. Well, what is the definition of child development? Studying child development. Here's one. Children change rapidly from the time of conception to adolescence, basing their new behaviors on previous learnings. The study of the child attempts to understand how physical, cognitive, social, emotional, and I added spiritual and behavioral changes take place. Now, the one line there that would need some explanation is basing their new behaviors on previous learnings. Not everything you do comes out of something you learned previously. Some things that you do come out of who you are and who God created you to be. But this is one definition by a secular source. All right, you could ask the question, in light of the fact that the Bible doesn't say much, why do we study child development? Why spend a lot of time studying child development? Well, I've developed a few here. Provides for self-insight and self-knowledge. And you might say that these go not necessarily in order of importance, but this is certainly one. I think that you're going to be thinking about yourself a lot this week. You're going to be thinking, you know, that makes sense. Or you'll think of a brother or sister and say, yes, I think that's right. I remember seeing that, or I see that in my classroom. As we learn more about children and ourselves, learn more about others. I just commented on that. Helps us understand, item C, helps us understand how people are alike and yet different. Helps us understand the uniqueness of each child. So one thing I want to emphasize is that children are unique. And we see mannerisms and personality traits, characteristics that we say, oh yes, that's just like Dad, or that's just like his grandpa or grandma or aunt or uncle. We notice all these traits and characteristics, and yet every child is unique. Item D, child development prepares people for parenthood and for careers involving children. And of course, we're looking at teaching. Well, what is the biblical basis? What are some scriptural categories for understanding children? What does the Bible say about children? What should be in place in our thinking as we think about children? And I want to begin with just some very, very fundamental things that we've probably all heard for a long time. But let's think about them specifically in relation to children. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God. God was first. God is the creator. God created the heavens and the earth. And that chapter goes on to say, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. He mentions all the things. Birds of the air. Beasts of the field. Everything. Have dominion over it. Let's just think about what's implied in those few lines. He created in his image. In his image. So each of us, look around the room. I mean, we all look different. I don't see any of you that really resemble each other enough to say that you're brother and sister, except a few that I might know that you are. And if I look long enough, I might recognize. But you look all new, and so I'm not putting anybody together. But you're made in God's image. Now, if you just look around, I see some of you doing that. You kind of look around. Okay, so we're all made in God's image. How does that change what I see when I look around? Made in the image of God. Now, I don't know what list of thoughts runs through your mind when you meet someone for the first time, or you meet a family or a group of people for the first time. There's a whole list of things. I mean, we notice a lot of things right away. There may be a striking feature. There may be, and I'm just going to be real forthright here. I think we probably automatically think in terms of age, things that categorize in terms of short, tall, white-complected, dark-complected, white hair, dark hair, blue eyes, brown eyes. The longer you look at the person, the more detail you notice. And I think we're all human enough to really also think of things like attractive, very attractive, not very attractive, and I hope you don't stay there. But we think in those terms. But remember, those terms need to be thought of in light of the fact that we're created in the image of God. Created in the image of God. So, unattractive. Well, in the image of God. So what does that mean when I relate to that person? And especially when I look at a child. Children come in all shapes and sizes, in all appearances. And if you work with children very long, they even come with different smells and different behaviors. Some are obnoxious, some are beautiful. But in every one of them, if you look long enough, you'll see something beautiful in every one. In the image of God created he him, male and female, male and female. We could talk a long time about differences between male and female. And then we have the verses, the words, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Right here we have children coming. Children. And notice how God pictures this happening. He says, be fruitful. Now that's a positive word. If a tree has fruit, we enjoy it. An apple tree, peach tree. If it's fruitful, it's a blessing. It's beneficial. We enjoy it. That's how God described the process of a man and a woman forming a home and saying, be fruitful. Be fruitful. Give something to life, to the creation. And as some have pointed out, we are in that simple possibility of being fruitful. God enables us to participate in creation. And we'll say a little bit more about that later. Replenish the earth. Subdue it. Have dominion over it. And in subdue and dominion, we have words that indicate teaching and relationship. Teaching and relationship in these words, subdue, have dominion. In order to subdue something, you have to know something about it. In order to have dominion, you need to know something about it. Therefore, in those words, we have implied teaching. Well, in Psalm 127, verse 3, we're told that children are an heritage from the Lord. So children come from God. It's very closely connected to this idea that we're made in the image of God. Children are a heritage from God. We're also told that God is intimately involved with every child's life. Even before birth, in Psalm 139, 13 to 16. It's a familiar passage. Let me just read those verses again to you. For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. Okay. So God was intimately involved with your existence, even from conception. That's the impact of Psalm 139, that from conception on, God was involved in your life and in the life of the children you teach and parent. Isaiah 42:6, we read that yesterday morning in church. But that verse, those verses talk about God giving breath and life to everything that is on the face of the earth. So God is still giving the breath of life to every living person. He sustains life. This child that irritates you, that sometimes we heave as teachers in the school, we all know this one child, and we sort of heave a collective sigh of relief when the child graduates. We're kind of glad to see him go. Well, God sustains the life of that child. What does that do to my view of the child? Tremendous value. What does the Bible say about the nature of children? What is the nature of a child? Well, let's think about several things the Bible says. Proverbs 22:15 says, "Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him." Okay, so foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Let's look at another verse. Proverbs 20, verse 11. "Even a child is known by his doings." Now, I like this verse in relation to child development. Do you remember what I said about child development largely being an observed subject? We have looked and observed, categorized, labeled, and come up with a subject called child development. Well, Proverbs 20 indicates that. "Even a child may be known by his doings." And I was curious about that as I thought about it in relationship to child development. And so I looked up the word "known." And the word "known" in that verse means to scrutinize, to look intently at. Doesn't that fit? This observable behavior that we're going to talk about this week. Even a child is known by his doings. Known. So when you scrutinize and you look intently at a child, it's amazing what you learn if you watch intently and you scrutinize and you ponder and you reflect and you think. In other words that are connected with that, to be acquainted with, to care for, respect, revere. Proverbs 17:6, "Children's children are a crown to the aged, and parents are the pride of their children." I've seen different translations of that verse. That's the NIV. But the point is clear, both in the King James and the NIV, that parents are the pride of the children. Or King James says that the glory of children are their parents, or their fathers. And so, my point here in this verse is just the fact that children can be a crown. Okay, so we know that there's foolishness bound up there. I want to expand on this a little bit later, but children can be a crown, and parents are the pride of their children. Proverbs 17:21, "To have a fool for a son brings grief. There is no joy for the father of a fool." Does this verse say that every child is a fool? Read it. Is that what it says? No. Not every child is a fool. But it says that if you do have a child that is a fool, it's a grief. There's no joy for the father of a fool. Proverbs 17:25, "A foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the one who bore him." A foolish son. Now, my point in these last two verses is that children can become fools. They can be foolish. But they are not all necessarily that way. And so the obvious implication is that given a child's choices, given the parenting this child received, they could become fools. So there is that potential in the nature of a child. But they are not necessarily fools just because they're children. And that's my last comment there in these verses. Children are not fools unless they choose to become one. Of course, parenting influences here as well. But the important thing to note is that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, not that they are all fools. And in thinking about the fact that they're not all fools, think about children are to be a joy and delight. In Luke 1, when the angel appears to the father of John the Baptist and tells him, "Look, you're going to have a son." You know what the next words were out of his mouth after he said, "You will have a son"? He will be a joy and delight to you. King James says, you will have joy and gladness. Joy and gladness because of this child. And I believe that children are to be a joy and a delight. If you care for your child, you need to do some serious thinking. Why can I not delight in this child? What does it say about me? What's showing up in my heart that's making it hard for me to delight in this child? Proverbs 29:17, discipline your son and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul. It may be that your discipline needs some work. It may also mean that your heart needs some work if you cannot delight in your child. I just want to be careful to say that more discipline is not always the answer if you cannot delight in your child. But children are persons, they're companions, they're friends. Delight in who they are, delight in their differences. Jesus said, except you become as a little child, except you become as a little child. And that ought to give us pause as we think about, what does that mean? Unless I become like a little child, I can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, that says something about the nature of a child and how precious and good it is, if I can use that word, good, about children. Jesus also said, whoso offendeth one of these little ones, be better for him have a millstone put on his neck and cast into the deepest part of the sea. Now that is a serious judgment on how we relate to children. Be better to have a millstone around your neck and tossed in rather than offending a little one. Another scripture that I think is significant in light of children, and I love this verse, in Luke 1:17. The angel told John the Baptist's father that John the Baptist would turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children. Now this is John the Baptist. If you're like me, you're thinking, okay, work of Christ, crucifixion, salvation, resurrection, he's going to come again, we need to live for him. But the work of John the Baptist was prepare the way for Jesus' coming, and before that was even stated, to turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children. You know what one of the last verses is of the Old Testament? That when this person whom God is going to send in Malachi, he talks about this. In Malachi, he says, this person will turn the hearts of fathers back to their children. As a teacher, you have tremendous potential to help your parents see their need and turn their hearts back to their children. In the very last verses of the Old Testament, Malachi 4, verse 5 and 6, see, I will send you the prophet Elijah. I'm reading out the NIV here. Before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes, he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse. That's amazing that God ends the Old Testament talking about this person who's going to come, and his job is to turn the hearts of fathers back to their children. I don't want us to miss the implications of that as we think about children. All right. Well, we said that in the overview sheet there, we're going to talk about seven things children need. I talked to a few of you during the break who were in child development class over the summer. This is review for you. So stay awake. Maybe you can use the review and maybe sink your teeth in it a little deeper. But I'm pulling out of a book by John Drescher, entitled Seven Things Children Need. And I'm using a lot of his material. A lot of the examples I give will be from my own experience, but I do give some of his examples, and I'm using his book as a format. And I'm starting out with the book, okay? So just think about the title, The Seven Things Children Need. He didn't say the seven. He just says seven things children need. May not be a complete list, but here's at least seven. Now, there are those in psychology who have started in their thinking with what's called a needs-based theory or view of child development. Okay, a needs-based. Now, others have chosen behavior as a basis and just looked at behavior in terms of describing what children need and what they're like. Others have said, well, I think there's some needs, and unless parents and teachers fill those needs, they won't be whole children. Well, there's some truth to that, and that's where this book comes, but I'm not espousing here a needs-based theory of child development or people. But I think we're all aware that we do have needs. There are areas that need attention as we look at children, and we're not going to make it all the way through these seven needs today, but we'll finish tomorrow. Number one is the need for significance. And he gives seven. And maybe I'll just show those to you here as an intro. Seven things children need. He talks about the need for significance, the need for security, the need for acceptance, the need to love and be loved, the need for praise, the need for discipline, and the need for God. Those are the seven areas he covers. I have to change papers here. Whenever we talk about significance, another word that comes up very quickly is the word self-esteem. And it's a loaded word these days. I've heard people denounce any use or mention of the word. I've heard people with the same energy and fervor say that you can't live without it. So we can talk about what is self-esteem. And I would certainly disagree with the way a lot of people use it today. A lot of the energy in public education today is given toward developing self-esteem. And Howard Hendricks gives an example in his book about his son. When he sent his son to school, when he took his son to school, the teacher said, you know, was so excited, and she was just wanting him to have a wonderful year. And by the end of the year, though, he could not read. Okay, now you have to understand that this son is now a Harvard graduate. Okay, so why couldn't he read at the end of first grade? Well, you know, she told Mrs. Howard Hendricks, she says, you know, it's not so important that he learns to read. It's important that he feels good about himself and that he enjoys school. And, of course, Hendricks asked the question. He says, well, did it ever occur to you, ma'am, that he'd feel much better about himself right now if he could read? He's frustrated that he can't read. He wants to read, and he can't read. So I'm certainly not espousing self-esteem in that light. But let's think about self-esteem. What enables you to go out and do something worthwhile? Whether it's hoeing the garden and leaving what's supposed to be there in a growing condition and taking the rest out, or whether it's sewing a dress or building a house or creating a piece of art, writing music, singing. What makes you think that you're able to do that? Well, just think about that. Why do you dare to assume? I'll just take myself for an example. I had my own painting business for a while. And I just kind of plunged in and started. I'd worked for a painter for a couple summers, but I decided I was going to try to do it on my own. And it was kind of scary. Why was it scary for me? Well, I hadn't done every kind of painting job that you had the potential of doing if you hang out a sign that says you paint. Okay? Now, it was scary. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it. And you, when you go to build a house or, you know, all those things I mentioned, what makes you think you're able to do that? Well, you know yourself well enough. Either you've had experience, someone has shown you how, and you've had successful experience. You've experienced the fact that you can do it. At least on some level, you can do it. And that experience and that knowledge adds to how you see yourself. You see yourself as capable of doing that. A person with no self-esteem would not see themselves as being able to do that. I can't do that. Haven't you heard children say that? I can't do that. You say, yes, you can. I know you can do it. Why don't you try? You can do that. Well, when you help that child through a successful experience, you've just added to their self-esteem, I like to think, in simply as giving the child a proper view of themselves. That's what self-esteem is, a proper view. Well, so what's a proper view? We could talk a long time, and we'll talk more about self-esteem later, but it's very simply a proper view of oneself, self-esteem. Because you do have a view of yourself. We can't erase you out of your perception and have anything left. You'd be a helpless, you wouldn't move out of your bed in the morning. You'd never get out. You'd stay right there and try to sleep away your life if you had no perception of yourself, as in self-esteem. So the need for significance, a healthy sense of personal worth is essential. We human beings need to be appreciated, noticed, and loved as we are. Now, this is not all we need, keep in mind, but we do need this. If you don't have any of this, you're in trouble. We need to be appreciated, noticed, and loved as we are if we are to have a sense of significance. If you've never been appreciated, if you've never been noticed, if you've never been loved, you probably wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here listening. Now, some of you have been appreciated, noticed, and loved a lot more capably and a lot more completely than others. And to the extent that you've been appreciated, noticed, and loved, you reflect that in how you relate to other people and how you see yourself. Number two, it is almost impossible to live with ourselves if we feel we are of little value or we don't like ourselves. And that's what I was saying earlier. You wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if you didn't like yourself. Why would Paul say to husbands, love your wives just like you love your own body? Why would Jesus say, what is the golden rule? Love like you want to be loved is the essence of it. Love like you love yourself. A lack of this sense of significance demonstrates itself at all ages. A teacher explaining an important concept in the class is interrupted by a little tyke who says, did you see my new sweater? I remember I did that in school one day. All day long, I was raising my hand. Every chance I had something I wanted to say. Had nothing to do with the subject at hand. And every period, you know how you do as teachers, you know when there's really something to be answered by this child. And so you often just ignore the hand. It's one way to save time, is to ignore the raised hand. Well, finally, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, she finally answered my hand. And I said what I wanted to say. I'm not even going to tell you what it was. It's too embarrassing. I was in the fourth grade. And I wanted to say that. And of course, she stopped and she made an appropriate comment. But it was totally unrelated to the lesson. I'm sure she's thinking to herself that night, what in the world? And so, but what was it? Why did I want to say? Well, I thought for once I had something funny to say. For once. I could say something that everybody might think was funny. So I wanted to say it. It wasn't a terrible thing. It's just, it's crazy, okay? So I'm not going to tell you. So, but the point is that children are this way. It demonstrates this need for significance. And I wanted to say it in class because I want everybody to laugh, okay? That would give me a sense of significance. And children do this. You're waxing eloquent on a great point, and your child raises their hand. You think, oh, great, here comes a great question or statement in response to what I'm saying. And they want to tell you how it rained last night. And you're like, oh, I never connected with that child. If not noticed in proper conduct, the child may seek it by spilling milk, throwing things on the floor in destructive ways. As someone suggested, a spanking is preferred to being ignored. And that's true. I've seen that happen. They'll do something bad so that you give them some attention. As children get older, the young person, he may race cars, lay rubber on the highway. And when you see these people and their obnoxious behavior, you ought to ask yourself, okay, wait a minute. Let me look beyond this. Instead of going over there and telling how ridiculous and immature and stupid and non-Christian this behavior is, and you should be thinking about his testimony, ask yourself, wait a minute, what's this person really asking for? And would I be much further ahead with this person by developing a friendship and by communicating, hey, I like you. Yeah, so you do some obnoxious things, but I like you. I think you're all right. Adults, we're more subtle at this. We're more subtle. This is where it hits home. But we may display something we've made. People that like to drop names. You know, they like to, oh yeah, I was talking to so-and-so. And, oh, do you know? Well, no, we met and we were talking and we do this. Or we dominate conversation. We may dress flamboyantly. We may demand leadership. We may demand a certain position. And as Drescher says, we may strive like fools for an honor or a degree, deserved or undeserved. Okay, just for a sense of significance. People will pursue degrees, will go to all lengths, and someone will say, you must really enjoy this if you're pursuing a doctorate in, you know, right brain activity. You must really be fascinated by the brain. If you talk long enough, you'd find out they might even hate it. But they're doing it because they're trying to prove to somebody that they can do this. And they may hate it. Gaining a sense of significance in childhood will build a foundation for emotional health and balance for the rest of your life. And if you didn't get it in childhood, you're going to have a very difficult time feeling a sense of significance in adulthood. And I want to talk a little more about what to do if that's the case for you. I really believe that the redemption that we can experience in Jesus Christ meets any need, but it does not erase the fact that we were legitimately influenced in those areas. But there is hope. That's the wonderful thing about the gospel, that there's always hope. Well, let's look at three false assumptions in relation to significance. Number one is the parent-child relationship should take priority over the husband-wife relationship. And a friend of mine was telling me recently how that these people came to the counselor friend and said, we can't give this child enough attention. This child will always want to come into our bed. We can't make it go into, can't make her go to her bed. She insists on sleeping in our bed. And if we try to force her to sleep in her bed, she'll scream and cry, and it's just, there's no end to this. What do we do? And so in asking a lot of questions and talking and discussing and getting them to describe the situation, he finally said, well, I'm going to come and just observe in your house. And so he came and spent a significant amount of time in their house. And in observing, he says, here's what I want you to do. Talked to the husband. He said, I want you to come home. And when you come home from work, I want you to sit down on the couch with your wife just for 30 minutes when you get home. Spend 30 minutes with your wife. And if your daughter comes and again insists on sitting between you, I want you to look at her and very firmly say, no, you go play. This is mommy and daddy's time. Okay. Well, parents said, this will never work. She will never let us do that. Well, make the long story short, they were able, the child did allow them to do that, and after doing that, the child became less and less insistent on sleeping in their bed, and over time, the problem erased altogether. The problem was that the parents never spent, they poured all their energy and attention to the child at the expense of the marriage, and it produced insecurity in the child. Now, some children may not have been that sensitive to that kind of situation, but this child was very alert to the relationship between mom and dad. After the first child, the real test takes place. And the more children you have, and as a teacher, of course, you have to spread it out over your classroom. And that's what makes it tough. I don't suppose that very many of you here are married today, but there may well come a time when you are. And that's why I think these comments are appropriate here. And you relate to parents. I think you need to understand this about parents. Remember that marriage is permanent while parenthood is passing. Now this is good for me to think about too. I have a 9-year-old, a 5, 3, and a 1-year-old. And it can get kind of crazy sometimes at our house. And sometimes we wonder if we'll ever have any time to ourselves anymore. But parenthood is passing. Marriage begins and ends with two persons. Keep that relationship in good repair. That's first. And so when you chide a parent for not spending enough time with the child, remember, the marriage is first, parenting is second. Think about it in those terms. The love of father and mother for each other is central to a child's sense of significance. Seeing and feeling the closeness and commitment of mother and father is essential. I think we've said enough there. Number two, the child, a false assumption, the child rightfully deserves to be the center of attention. The child rightfully deserves to be the center of attention. That's a false assumption. What can I get rather than what can I give becomes a way of life when this is true for a child. Sorry, I'm getting this too high. Just raise your hand and tell me if you can't read something. I'll get this print bigger by tomorrow. Most of us want our children's love more than anything else and feel it represents proof that we are doing a good job of being parents. We can make that at teachers. We want our students' love. You walk in the class, you say, I want these students to like me. Who of us doesn't, at least on some level, feel that? We want these students to like us. And that's what's behind this assumption. So we make them the center of attention. And it's the wrong approach. In former years, the majority of parents wanted mainly respect from their children, which made things considerably easier. Here, psychologist here that's being quoted is saying that a generation or two ago, parents wanted to be respected by their children. That was the most important thing. Well, along came a lot of thinkers along about the 60s and 70s and told parents how much their children needed love, and that spanking was wrong, and that the child needs to be able to express themselves. Well, when that came along, parents began to feel guilty any time they demanded something out of the child. The child didn't feel like doing. I mean, what child does feel like being obedient all the time or respectful all the time? Well, what has happened, and I've been influenced by this as a parent. I know I have, and that I want my child to love me. And at times, find it easy to compromise on insisting that he also respect me as a parent. And the same thing is true in the classroom. You remember the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, where children were meant to be seen and not heard? That's what I'm talking about. That's respect. Didn't matter if you didn't feel a lot of love for mom or dad at the dinner table for not being allowed to talk. The important thing was that you respect them enough to be silent. Okay? There's something to be said for that. Number three, a false assumption, the child should be pushed rapidly into more mature roles. And that's the parent who wants them to read at 3 and add and subtract at 4 and 5 and all those things. Not saying it can't be done. Children at a very young age have been taught to add and subtract. It's kind of fascinating if you want to read up on it sometime. Teaching Your Child Math. Teaching Your Baby, I think the title of the book is. Math. Some fascinating things that can be done with children. But the goal should not be to raise a little Einstein, you know. A child must be, as we said earlier, a person and enjoyed for who they are. Some destructive forms that destroy significance: ridicule, sarcasm, scorn, and contempt. Sometimes you read through the book of Psalms. Look how many times David asked God to deliver him from shame and contempt. That's not something we think about very often, but every time you laugh, even though it may be in good faith, you don't really mean anything by it, but you laugh at somebody for making, sort of pulling a little, you know, you did something foolish or ridiculous or whatever. We laugh at them, and that may be fine. I'm not condemning that. But when you do it to a child, look out. And haven't you even been laughed at in public situations where, yeah, you kind of laugh with them, but you laugh with them because it's better to laugh with than to be laughed at, you know. So, ridicule, sarcasm, scorn, and contempt. You find out very quickly when you work with children how much some of these things are just part of the way you relate. It was for me. Sarcasm was just my native humor as I came out of my teen years. And I found that it did not engender relationship at all with young people and children. Number two, a fit of anger can scar someone for life. A fit of anger. I remember one time when I lost my temper with one of my boys, and he was, I think, 4 years old at the time. This is just this past fall. And I just berated him and told him how I didn't appreciate what he had done and, you know, never do it again kind of thing. And so the next day, I tried to bring him to school here once a week for lunch, just to do lunch with me. I live real close. So we were walking down through this Alaskan highway here. It was raining outside. And I stopped. And we look out the window. We were watching it rain, watching the water run down off the hill. We're both in this little window there. We're looking out the window, watching it rain. And I have him propped up, and he's got his elbows on the windowsill. I got my head right there beside him. And he's standing there. And we're looking out the window, watching it rain, and looking at the huge rivers running down the hill. It's just pouring rain. And so we stood there and talked about it, and I said, hey, remember last night when I got angry? We're still looking out the window, and we're just talking. Yeah, Dad, I remember. I remember when you got... I said, well, hey, I said, that really wasn't very nice. I shouldn't have... It was wrong for me. I said, you weren't right in what you were doing, but it was wrong of me to be angry and say what I did. And I told him what I had said that I thought was wrong. I said, you remember that? You know what I mean? Yeah, Dad, I remember. He said, Dad, you told me one time you'd never get angry at me. And Dad, I think that's lying. We're still watching it rain, okay? And I said, did I say I'd never get angry? And he said, yeah, Dad, you did. Well, I think I'm smart enough to know that I would never say that I never get angry, because I know that I'm human, I get angry. But that wasn't a time for arguing, it was a time for apologizing. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, I know I got angry. And I said, I probably shouldn't have promised you that never to get angry, because I said, I know I lose my temper sometimes, but I do promise you that I always like you. Okay? You're always my boy, I always like you. I promise you that. Even if I get angry, remember that, you know, it's wrong and that I still like you for my boy. Well, he remembered the fact that I had said, he understood me to say that I'd never be angry. Very destructive. That moment of anger, it took me a while to build that back. Laughing. We talked about laughing at a child for a simple mistake. And parents who have said, and we hear these stories too many times, and I've heard them, this is one out of the book, but I've heard very similar, so I give it to you here. I can find it here. Let's read it off the overhead. Father says to son, I don't know what you're going to be. I can't imagine anybody giving you a job. You'll never make anything of life. Can you imagine hearing that from your parent? You hear, if the child hears it enough times, he'll believe it. He'll begin to live and act out of that belief. And number five, your personal security base. I'll just take a little bit of time right here and have you pause and think a little bit. What is my personal security base? Okay, well, you say, my security base is Jesus Christ. Well, that's great. But without Jesus Christ, what is it? What is the security base that tends to hover there in the back of your consciousness as you think back? And I want you to think a little bit now, back over your growing up years. What is the one sense or statement that comes to your mind as you think of your growing up years? As you think about growing up, and you want to think of one statement or two that describes, that sort of encapsulates growing up. Let me give you some examples. One man said that a man he was talking to, grew up next to a brick factory. And his father worked 12-hour days in this brick factory. And they were right next door, and they were too poor to move, didn't make enough money to move. And he said his mother had to dust the house every day because there was just this brick dust floating through the air all the time. And she was constantly cleaning the house. And they wanted to move, but couldn't afford it. But he said, you know, he says, I grew up believing I could do anything I wanted to do if I just put my mind to it. Because anything I say, hey, Dad, what about this? And Dad said, sure, son, go for it. You can do it. Try. And he said, I grew up believing I could do it. Another man tells a story of how that as he was growing up, he was just an unusual child. He was very creative, but never did anything the traditional, normal way. And he just remembers his dad. And he comes charging in the room and, hey, Dad. And his dad listens and says, can't you ever do anything normal? Okay. He said, when I think back growing up, he is a prominent sociologist, has doctorate in sociology. And whenever he has a creative idea, he has to battle this thing of, first thing that comes to his mind when he has an unusual creative idea is, can't you just be normal? Can't you just be normal? And it's still with him. Well, that's what I mean by personal security base. What is one thing, one statement that comes to your mind? You ought to just jot a few ideas. Maybe you have a difficult time isolating anything. But what is one thing that comes to mind? Just jot down. I'm just going to give you 30 seconds or so. Jot down a few things, possibilities. You might have to work at this for a while. But you got to think about, what is it? What is my personal security base? What comes to mind? Look over my past, my growing up years. Now, I'd just encourage you to find a couple of friends and discuss this issue as it relates to your lives. What is my personal security base? Another way to ask that would be just, how do I feel about being successful in life? How do I feel about being successful in life? Well, that's a feeling question, but I guarantee you it drives the way you address your job, the way you respond in relationships. All of those areas operate right out of that. And I want to say at the same time, the deeper your walk with the Lord, the greater your relationship there, the more and more you're going to have victory and overcome that sense. But there is some sense going to be there, at least if it's a negative sense, you will overcome that. It's the reason some people at 19 go and start a multi-million dollar company at 19. Someone else manages to pull it off when they're 50. There's a reason for those things. All right, let's talk about adequacy, self-identity, and personal worth. Again, the sense of adequacy. All of us have places where we don't feel adequate, and that's normal. But how much inadequacy you experience is wrapped up in this idea of significance. All three of these are wrapped up in this basic need of significance. This thing of adequacy begins early. And the amount of affirmation and encouragement you get from the same-sex parent, the sense of ability, the sense of capacity, comes. And it's interesting to me to note that twice in the New Testament we read that God the Father speaks audibly over His Son, Jesus Christ, and says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." At one point it says, "Hear ye Him." Now, why did God do that? Well, part of it was to lend credibility to Jesus' ministry, I believe. But it is also true that He spoke this at times. And I believe it increased Jesus' sense of adequacy, who He was. And I think I might have put that in the wrong place in my notes. I want to comment that more on number three here, sense of identity. Sense of identity comes primarily from the opposite sex parent. Example, Jesus in the temple and His temptation in the wilderness. And of course, I want to be sensitive here to maybe those of you who have only had, maybe come from single parent homes. Let's say you only had ever had a mom. You don't know your dad. Okay? I don't think you were necessarily irreparably damaged, because God says He's a father to the fatherless, and He has a special place in His heart for the orphan. And so I believe God has special grace for people who don't have both parents. However, this sense of identity coming from the opposite parent, if you're a daughter, your father, if you're a son, your mother, is very essential. Your sense of identity. Just a very basic example. A mother who never allows her son privacy when he uses the bathroom. Now, some families are very free in a healthy way, but there are other families who the parent may never allow the opposite sex child the privacy as they get older. And it's a serious violation when it's done in an uncaring, insensitive way. Now, that's an extreme example, maybe. But there are those families who are not sensitive to those issues. And it has strong implications to the sense of identity. Something else you need to think about in this whole issue of identity. One reason we think it's not that big a deal is that many of us come from healthy homes. And we grow up knowing mom and dad love me. I just grow up knowing it. They may never even have told me they love me, but I just sensed, I always knew that mom and dad would be there. Do not underestimate the value of that knowledge, that mom and dad will always be there. All you have to do is work with people who did not have that knowledge, who never knew if mom would commit suicide the next day, who never knew if dad would be there the next morning or not, who never knew if dad would come home sober or drunk. Talk to those people and see the significance of these issues that we're talking about here. Number four, self-worth. Again, arises primarily from the sense that I am loved, I am valued, I am liked just as I am. I am liked just as I am. Well, how do you build significance? We've been talking about some of these things. We'll run through this very quickly. Your attitude toward yourself as a parent or a teacher is basic and will affect your child's self-esteem. If you don't like yourself, if you think you're not much of anything, your child will not think much of themselves either, because you're going to treat them the same way that you feel about yourself. Now, how is that different from the Apostle Paul saying, I count my background as dung, I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. In the life I now live, in the flesh I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Notice he lives. Notice that Paul's personality was not erased. Notice that Paul's vision and his drive, he was an energetic man before he was saved, he was energetic after he was saved. Some things, Paul was still Paul. And that's what I believe we're talking about here. I think Jesus speaks to all of these situations, but these are the things that are live issues as we parent and teach. Let your child help around the home. Again, a study done recently, and it's, you know, as Christians, we knew this a long time ago, but there's been this big push on self-esteem, and a recent study I read showed that, you know, we've discovered that praise is a lot more effective if you praise for achievement rather than just praising. Tell the child, you're wonderful, you're special, you're great, you're fantastic, man, you're wonderful. Well, I think there's a time to praise that way, but they said praise for real life achievement is much more effective. You know, I tell my boys, I like you just because you're you. But if I'd never require anything of them, they would become brats, forgive the term. You know, nobody'd like them. They'd be the grief to the father and mother that Proverbs talks about. They'd become foolish. And what they're finding out in this study, that children that grow up this way, praise for no achievement, just tell them how wonderful they are and they'll do the right thing kind of philosophy. They grow up violent, don't learn very well, they don't have any sense of security, all those things. So let your child help around the home. That builds significance. Introduce your child to others. One's name is awfully important to a child as well as to an adult. Been around parents where the children are just a necessary nuisance, and they don't include them in the conversation. They don't introduce the children to you. They're just sort of tagging along. It does something for your children to introduce them and include them in the conversation. Let children speak for themselves. Let children speak for themselves. The overprotective mother hen that's always hovering nearby, and whenever the child asks a question, oh, well, yeah, he just really loves eggs, and he just loves to play ball, or he loves to go outside. And so that you try again, you ask the child, so, Johnny, what do you like to do outside? And right away the parents, oh, he just loves to play ball. Never let the child speak for themselves. And the child just kind of stands there and never learns. What he does learn is that he's not capable of answering for himself. And he gets old enough, and he'll do the same thing. He's not capable. So everybody around him will have to do things for him. Give the child the privilege of choice and respect opinions whenever possible. Personality develops through making decisions. We'll talk more about relinquishing control as a teacher and a parent later. Spend time with your child. Time. Someone has said love is spelled T-I-M-E. Number 7, encourage the feeling of worth and significance by trusting your child occasionally with things which surprise him. In other words, instead of everything needing to be requested, surprise him once in a while by saying, hey, why don't you go and do something that he was not expecting to be able to do? All right. Children crave security. Security. It needs to be said, except that if you watch long enough, a child that does not have a sense that there is something whole about his world is in trouble. Number 2, conditions which create insecurity. Parental conflict. 3 most frequently mentioned reasons for using drugs in one study in order of the times mentioned was A, parental conflict. Number one on that, in that particular study that came up, was parental conflict. Drescher in his book says that one juvenile delinquent officer, probation officer, when asked about the people that he meets with, said that he has never had anyone that has been meeting with him that had a healthy marriage growing up in their parents. If their parents had a healthy marriage, he did not see that child in his office as a probation officer. Desire for personality change, wishing they were someone else, and then peer group pressures. One thing about parental conflict, you ought to ask yourself, especially if you're looking to get married, and maybe you're dating someone right now, it'd be an interesting question to ask each other. So, how did your mom and dad fight? And if they had a disagreement, they said it's time for you to go outside. Mom and dad need to talk. Okay? And they sent children outside. Someone else, you ask him, oh, my mom and dad, oh, they threw things. And yelled at each other. They threw things. Well, there's every different kind of relationship, but if those same parents that threw things and yelled also knew how to hug and make up and kiss as parents in front of the children, those children will not be necessarily damaged by that conflict of seeing mom and dad yell and throw things. But if they see them yell and throw things and things. How do you think their first fight might go? It'll be the shock of the life, and it will be tremendous. It'd be good to be able to talk about how you deal with conflict. I'm not recommending that people throw things when they fight. What I'm saying is it's not so much the conflict. Conflict is inevitable in life. If you are living to avoid conflict, God be with you. But it's how you deal with the conflict that matters. Okay, mobility. Moving again and again. It's interesting. I moved out here last year, and one of my younger sons, I try not to give names too much, but one of my younger sons still says, he's about over it, but he still says, and we drive down the road, and we come to the stop sign where he knows to turn to go to our house, still says, I don't want to go to mommy's house. I don't want to go to mommy's house. Just as a parent, that troubles me a little bit. It's been troubling me because I wonder, okay, How much damage am I doing here? And he does need a lot of security, much more so than some of the others. What am I doing? What's he thinking and feeling that he never wants to go to mommy's house? He'd much rather go to grandma's house back home or somewhere else. And it's been very unsettling for me to try to help him process that, because he's not the age where you can, you know, just sit down and reason and all that. So how do I create a climate for my son that gives the kind of security that he still wants to go to mommy? He wants to be with us all the time. It's not that he doesn't want to be with us, but he doesn't want to go to mommy's house, because all I can figure out, it symbolizes where he needs to stay. He doesn't want to stay there. Something else that creates insecurity is a lack of proper discipline, not knowing real boundaries. We've talked about that. Absence of parents. U.S. News here a year or so ago had an article about latchkey kids, we call them now. Children that come home from school and mom and dad are never home. They're on their own for an hour or two after school. Creates insecurity. Continual criticism. Someone has said that you need to praise 4 times for every criticism or correction. Other people I've heard say as much as 10 times. If you're going to correct and be effective and maintain the child's growth as a person, you need to praise. And there's some good ways to praise. We heard over the weekend, this isn't the only way, but there's a good way to praise. Number one, you state the quality that you like. So the example I believe that was given was that Johnny gets up and starts clearing the table without being told. It's always his job, but often you know how it goes. Okay, come on, guys, boys, girls, clear the table. Okay, well, this time he gets up and does it without being told. So you say, Johnny, I just really appreciate how you showed initiative in clearing the table. So you named a quality that you like. And then you... physical touch becomes extremely important, where you can lay a hand on the shoulder and say, you know, I just really appreciate when you do that. And I don't remember how all this was explained over the weekend, but praise, when it's you name the quality and you touch and you look them in the eye and you say, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. And I think you're doing a good job. Things rather than persons, when they get more attention, when they get more money, more gifts than they do time, it creates insecurity. If mom and dad are insecurity, if they're always afraid that the economy is going to collapse, they're always afraid there's going to be a worldwide nuclear catastrophe, and they talk about this in front of the children, if they're always afraid that so-and-so isn't going to like them, or if they're going to lose a job, all those things are communicated all the time. It will create insecurity. Well, what does build security? Security between father and mother. How much displayed affection children see. And I talked about that earlier. I believe it's tremendously important for children to see affection between mom and dad. And if you're a teacher, to see healthy relationships between you and other people. They need to see you as a real person. A person who knows how to love and show care. Number two, a rich and continuing love of parents for the child. Rich and continuing love, including them. All these things we've been talking about, including them, looking them in the eye, hugging, playing, family togetherness. We've heard the saying, the family that prays together stays together. Well, we could add some things. The family that plays together stays together. The family that works together. The family that visits other people together stays together. A regular routine. Something that's been fun at our house is to have pizza every Saturday night. That's just our tradition. We have pizza. My wife Marie makes pizza. Well, Sunday mornings we also, every Sunday morning we always have baked oatmeal. That's just our Sunday morning breakfast. And we've noticed that those little things add a sense of regularity. And if you have a family Bible reading time, all those things add that sense of routine. This is what we do. And if you miss it, they'll be sure to let you know. Proper discipline. We've mentioned that. Proper discipline builds security. If you discipline, not out of anger, but in self-control, and you are clear about what it is you're doing, and you know how to show love, proper discipline increases security. Touching your child, I've mentioned that. Hugging, kissing, touching your child. As teachers, what about touching your children? If you are familiar with the BECCA program and read or heard them talk about their philosophy with children, of course, they have a big emphasis on community schools. And so they have the whole issue of litigation and suing comes up when you think about touching and discipline with children in school. And so you need to be alert to that if you have community children, but especially in the elementary years. I think it's special when a teacher can kneel down or squat down beside a student at their desk, put an arm around them and say, here, let's try to do this together. Or put an arm around, put a hand on the shoulder and say, hey, I think you're doing a fine job here with this problem or this worksheet. But touch is powerful, powerful. Many children, I say many, depends where you're teaching, what kind of children you're teaching, but too many children do not experience enough touch, especially from their dads. Too many dads stop touching their children. After they get about 3 or 4 or 5 years old, they stop touching. And it's a tremendous deficit there. Okay. We're going to stop there. And the rest of these in this book will not take this much time, and we'll get on to a number of other things. I'd like to stop now and if you have a piece of paper handy, write down a couple questions. We've talked about teachers and the influence they have. We've talked about some needs in children's lives. We've talked about your personal security base. Here's the first question. How do I view children? Especially you men here ought to think about this. Of course, I'm thinking out of my own experience here, but when I was single, I didn't have a great love for children. I'm not like I see some of you doing. When you see someone else's children, you're quick to pick them up. I never did that. I mean, I didn't hate them. I just was not attracted to children that way, to other people's children. I cared. I didn't like, I resented people being unkind. I was not unkind or mocking, but I was not drawn to them. Well, how do you view children? And I think in your groups, you ought to just spend some time talking about that. Thank you, Leroy. How do I view children? And I just see you going around the circle and just saying, well, here's how I view children. And if you want to add anything to that, it might be helpful to do that. Why do I view them this way? Next question. Tell the group one incident when some adult, a teacher, parent, whoever, left an unmistakable impression or influence for good in your life. In other words, I read you this article about, he was talking about his teachers and the influence they had. I'd like you to think about one. And again, if you're like me, at 23, I try to think back as I started teaching and began to hear people tell stories about the childhood. I'm trying to think, wait a minute, I can't remember anything about my elementary school years. And so I began to think, and I kept cards in my pocket, and every time I thought of something, no matter how insignificant, I jotted it down. Oh yeah, I remember first grade, I wrote it down. And it was amazing. Over a year or two period of time, I began to remember much, much more. But it took some prodding. Maybe you don't need that prodding. Some people I hear talk about all kinds of things. You remember all kinds of things. Well, that wasn't me. Think of one or two incidents when some adult left an unmistakable impression or influence for good. And then if you want to share one, maybe that was negative. That'd be fine too. Because I'm sure most of us, probably all of us, have something somebody did that we remember that was negative. So I think this exercise is important as we think in terms of how I view children, how I relate to them, what my view is. I think it will be very relevant to your teaching. So why don't we do this by table, by side here. Take one row, and if you just want to, part of you want to pull your chair around. I guess I only work here in the front. Or form a circle. It's be a lot of little places. You might have to do is be creative. You may just want to stand. Find a place to stand in a group and talk. Or if you want to sit down in a corner, that's fine too. But you'll be dismissed. After you're done, you may go. But bring your answers tomorrow, okay? Appoint one person to keep track of these. Jot down enough that you can talk about it a little bit.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.